Mr. Jones.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Bill Jones. I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. I represent the appellant, Mr. Newman. I was appointed to represent Mr. Newman in the case below after he had entered a plea of guilty. There are two assertions made by Mr. Newman, either of which would serve as a basis for a finding of an abuse of discretion in this case. First, he did not knowingly and intelligently enter a plea of guilty. The plea colloquy shows Mr. Newman expressly denied exercising control over a firearm that was at issue in the case and said, rather clearly actually, that he was pleading guilty to constructive possession because he was in the car when someone else was possessing the gun, and he felt that was the definition of constructive possession. The definition used in the court's denial of his motion to withdraw his plea even references the requirement that he have both the power and intention to exercise dominion and control over the firearm in order to be deemed to have constructively possessed it. So, you know, basically how the court came to a conclusion that in the face of his outright denial that he ever possessed or controlled the weapon, he had constructively possessed it and therefore it must have knowingly understood what the elements of the charge was.
Mr. Jones, did Mr. Newman get charged with carjacking?
I think in state court, yes. I think he may still be facing that charge.
Ah, okay.
Kidnapping as well, probably.
Yes, probably. Yes, I think so. Yes.
Because frankly, I was wondering if this plea is set aside on this kind of theory, it looks like he could still be charged federally with the carjacking, which would tend to carry heavier sentences than he's facing here.
I suppose he's looking to cross that bridge when it comes, but he wanted to withdraw his plea and have a trial on whether he possessed the weapon.
Okay.
Perhaps he figured, I don't know his mindset as to how he would want to proceed or whether even it's logical, I just know.
Okay. We're still in the pretrial phase, in essence, I understand.
Sure.
But the account of facts here looks like it would make it possible to hold him accountable for the gun under the sentencing guidelines or something like 924C, where you've got where you're working with a co-defendant. The,
sure.
The 922G standard is a little tighter, and maybe this falls between them.
I agree. Reasonable expectation that someone would possess a weapon is different than constructive possession, and yeah. Perhaps this does fall in between them. But as it relates to his understanding of the elements of this crime and the definition, I think in the plea colloquy he mentions, you know, I'm doing this because my understanding is constructive possession means being in a car with someone who is possessing a weapon, and that's not the definition. You have to actually exercise power or control over it. Secondly, according to Torzala, which is a case I referenced in the brief, if the court demonstrates an incorrect belief of the elements of the crime, a plea is unconstitutionally invalid. And the court really shouldn't have relied on the government's level of comfort in the plea colloquy, but instead based its own determination on a correct interpretation of the definition of constructive possession. His pleading guilty in this case really demonstrates, I think, his lack of understanding of the elements of the charge and therefore was unconstitutionally invalid. Lastly, I find the U.S. v. Rawlings case really indicative and helpful in this case. In that particular case, a getaway driver asserted that he was unaware that everyone was armed going into a bank.
For how long after the defendant found out about the Confederates' guns did he remain involved?
Well, what he said at the plea hearing was that he was unaware that he had gone armed. He was asking for a cigarette. You know, these are all facts.
Could you address my question, please? For how long after he found out that they were armed did he remain involved?
In Rawlings or in this case?
In Rawlings.
Well, voluntarily or involuntarily?
I'm asking for time. We can talk about
sure.
States of mind later.
The car was later abandoned in Eau Claire, I think, or La Crosse. I can't remember which city. They maintain
position. One reason I ask this question,
two of you may not know, is that the Supreme Court decided a somewhat similar case this morning. It's Rosemond against the United States. I'm shocked
Judge
that the two of you haven't been sitting reading this morning's Supreme Court cases.
The Rosemond is technically an aiding and abetting case, but it also involves attributing A's gun to B in a multi-person felony. And the Supreme Court says that the attribution of one participant's gun to another is proper only if either the person who isn't toting the gun knows beforehand that the gun toter will tote it, or if that person stays with the crime after knowing that the gun toter is toting a gun. Now, I don't know how long the interval was in Rosemond, but it appears to be quite substantial here. I'm not even going to pronounce the Confederate's name. Well, maybe I have to. Ms. Levick? Newman apparently stayed with Ms. Levick for quite some time, knowing that Ms. Levick was wielding a gun in what appears to be their joint interest. And if one goes by the standard of Rosemond, that appears to be quite sufficient to attribute the gun to Newman.
Well,
now, maybe you can see, I obviously don't expect the two of you to have spent this morning huddled over your computers, but perhaps some supplemental filings concerning the question I've just asked about Rosemond and the bearing, if any, sorry, the question I've just asked about Rawlings and then the bearing, if any, of Rosemond and the analysis of Rosemond on this case may be in order.
I'd be happy to file a supplemental brief on it after I had a chance to look at it. I spent this morning in traffic, so.
We tend to discourage people from reading their computers while they're in the audience here. So.
It took a while to get the last 40 miles finished on my ride, so I deserve 3 minutes, so I'll just...
I'm surprised that you don't have text-to-speech software that will read decisions of the Supreme Court through your car's audio system as you're driving.
Someday.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Ms. Rumbelow, I assume you haven't read it either.
No, I have not, Your Honor. Sorry. Good morning. Rita Rumbelow for the United States. I first will address the court's questions in the order they came. To address Judge Hamilton's question, Mr. Newman is not charged with carjacking, and he can't be federally because he didn't cross state lines. He didn't even leave our judicial district. We researched that prior to making our charging decision. But he is currently charged in Jackson County Circuit Court, according to paragraph 52 of the PSR, of escape, kidnapping, and a variety of offenses, a total of 7. And as for Judge Easterbrook's question about Rawlings, the facts in Rawlings were Rawlings was the getaway driver right before, and he knew they were going to be participating in a bank robbery, but he said, I had no idea my co-conspirators were armed until they got out of the car, as they got out of the car.
The question I ask, though, is how long after that happened, how long after he sees somebody with a gun, does he remain involved in the crime? That's the question the Supreme Court poses in Rosemond. And, of course, you'll want to pay particular attention to footnote 9 of Rosemond, yes. Which addresses that issue in greater detail.
But in Rawlings, he stayed in the car. He remained as the getaway driver. He waited while the co-conspirators went to the bank. They came out. The law enforcement was chasing them, and he talked his co-conspirators into getting rid of the guns, throwing them out of the window of the car. So how long specifically that was, I don't know, but Rawlings did not abort his decision to be the getaway driver after finding out that his co-conspirators were armed. And here, in this case, a very careful review of the transcript of the plea hearing. Twice on the record, it was stated, pursuant to the government's Rule 11 proffer, that the victim would have testified that both Newman and Ms. Levick said to her, "We stole this gun." So we know, and Newman never, ever, ever disputed that factual assertion by the government. On either occasion, he just kept really focusing on the kidnapping itself, and he's saying, I was just merely asking the victim for a cigarette, and unbeknownst to me, my co-defendant came out with this gun and forced her into the car. Well, whether we find that credible or not.
doesn't that suggest that there's a factual dispute? I mean, the question is whether the defendant understood the legal standard, right?
Right. But he...
And go ahead.
Sorry, at the plea hearing, He never contested the victim. The victim would have testified at trial that both of these individuals, Newman and Ms. Levick, told her, "We stole this gun." So we know at the outset that Newman willingly engaged in joint possession of this firearm. He procured it with Ms. Levick. But then he wants to distance himself and say, well, that's not really constructive possession because I never actually touched it. But we know from the facts at the plea hearing that he helped procure the shotgun.
Well, it can mean a lot of different things. But is there any indication here that Newman had any kind of power over Ms. Levick?
Well, he willingly escaped, walked away from this correctional facility.
Power over him. I mean, what I'm thinking about is you get these guys are partners in the escape, but the guy who has the gun seems to be in the more powerful position.
Well, if he were, Newman could have at any time distanced himself. I will be curious to read this Rosemount decision, but Newman never distanced himself, and they kept this woman in this car for hours. I think it was 4 to 5 hours. Never did he stop. And so Newman wants this court to believe that he didn't exercise any control and that he never, ever, ever would have used the shotgun for their joint protection. Well, that's just incredible. He, again, helped procure the shotgun, and even after they got it, he still went along with Ms. Levick. In the parking lot of this casino where this woman was getting off work early in the morning, he approaches her to ask for a cigarette. Now, common sense would dictate that he was trying to, you know, divert her attention so Ms. Levick could come up with the shotgun. Because why go along with Ms. Levick after he takes the shotgun but to continue to commit more crimes with the shotgun? What would be the purpose? They had just escaped from a correctional camp. So he then gets in the car with Ms. Levick. When Ms. Levick comes up, if we believe his story that he had no idea Ms. Levick was going to come up and point the shotgun at this woman, even if accepting his version of facts is true, Newman could have, at that point in time, in the parking lot of the casino, said, "I'm not going along." There's no evidence in the record to suggest that Ms. Levick made him go along, pointed the shotgun at him to make him get in the car, nothing. Newman willingly went along with Ms. Levick in this car.
Those are great arguments for the sentencing guidelines for a 924C enhancement. But power and intent to exercise control over the gun is the standard for the 922G charge, right?
Correct.
So how does he have the power and intent?
First of all, he helped procure it. He remained in this car, very small car, only three people. The shotgun's right there in the passenger compartment of the car. Then when they decide to release this woman, he still doesn't stop. You know, joint possession for their joint protection, for their joint criminal ventures. There was absolutely no other reason to steal the shotgun. None. And Newman went along every single step of the way. Every step of the way. He never distanced himself. And then even after deciding to release this woman, he still goes along with Ms. Levick in another stolen truck with the shotgun, which they did then subsequently abandon together. And then he continued to travel to Florida with Ms. Levick after that, committing more crimes along the way. So it would belie common sense, I think, that Ms. Levick has so much control over Newman. That's just not the record here. Newman just willingly went along. Yeah, I'll do whatever he wants to do. I will go along with it. And so when he helps procure the shotgun, tells the victim that they just stole it, and remains in this three different criminal ventures, stealing the gun, kidnapping a woman, and then stealing another truck, all while armed, I would argue that that is constructive possession because it was joint possession for their joint criminal ventures. Sorry, Judge Manion.
I would focus more on is the word benefit ever come into constructive possession? Obviously, he benefited from the other person's possession.
Absolutely.
And I just wondered if that frames into the definition, because there's no question he went along. You keep saying that. He went along with it and stayed with it and that sort of thing. I have a hard time comparing it to the getaway driver, because obviously he's driving the car. I guess if he told him to throw the guns out, that may have been an interesting variation. But clearly, Newman benefits from this.
Absolutely. The shotgun was an integral part of the armed kidnapping.
For the whole thing to keep going.
Yes, to keep this woman in the car.
Well, he isn't touching it or possessing it or whatever. Now, the other thing is he claims to have been locked in the car. I guess the childlike was on, and he was in the back seat, and the gun was in the front seat. Well, I guess he went to steal another truck or something. Isn't that how that works?
Right. He remained in the car with the victim with the gun.
It was
against the woman drove.
He's leaving the gun in the car. He says, I got to go get another car. And
Ms. Levick left the gun in the car, went and stole the truck.
What?
According to Newman, again, this is all his version, he remained in the car with the kidnapping victim and the shotgun.
Right.
While Ms. Levick went and stole another truck. And then at some point, the shotgun got from the victim's car to the stolen truck. There aren't any facts in the record as to how
the guy put it in the stolen truck. He still gets in it and off they go.
There aren't any facts in the record as to how.
Apparently, he didn't need the gun to steal the other truck, which that's pretty curious. But
right,
you know, off they went and somehow made it to Florida.
Yes, after abandoning that second truck, they went to Florida and continued to commit additional crimes.
I don't know about those. I was curious how he got to Florida.
We still don't know to this day.
I just use the word benefit. I don't know whether that's part of a definition or not.
It's not, but I think there is case law. Well, in the Moore decision, they talk about how the firearm was an integral part of those armed robberies. And here, this shotgun. Why else steal a shotgun if you're not intending to use it to commit more crimes? And here they were able to force this woman into this car at gunpoint. Otherwise, maybe she wouldn't have gone along if they wouldn't have had the shotgun.
So if what you just told us is right, there was a time when the kidnapped victim and Newman were the only ones in the car.
According to Newman, yes.
And there was, and the gun was also present in the car.
I believe so. It's not clear on the record.
Okay.
I don't want to misstate the record, but according to Newman, he remained in the car with the kidnapping victim when Ms. Levick went and stole another truck. Whether Ms. Levick took the shotgun with him to steal that truck, that was, or not, is not in the record.
Okay.
But I will happy to read the new Supreme Court decision and file supplemental briefing as this court orders.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rumbelow. Anything further, Mr. Jones?
As it relates to the procurement of the weapon, that is not what the record says. It doesn't say that there was a weapon left in the car, and as a matter of fact, I don't remember my client ever saying that it was that the gun was sitting in the car with this woman who was part of the carjacking. At the plea, the court asked Mr. Newman, is there anything you believe the government would not prove? And he says, I didn't possess a gun. I never touched the gun. I wasn't in possession. I didn't even know the robbery was going on. I was asking the lady for a cigarette, so I didn't even rob nobody. I wasn't even participating in that act. I was more shocked that that happened. But I am guilty of constructive. I knew the gun was in the vehicle that I was in. That's how the plea went. And as I raised the issue in the motion, as I raised it in the appeal and got the reply brief, no one is really addressing whether or not he understood what he was pleaing to. It seems to be totally glossed over the fact that he felt that constructive possession was merely being in a car with someone else who had a weapon, and that is one of the core elements of having an appropriate plea is that the defendant totally understands exactly the elements that he's pleading to. Anything further?
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Jones. The court invites the parties to file supplemental memoranda addressing the significance of this morning's Supreme Court decision, the significance, if any, of this morning's Supreme Court decision. The memoranda are due within 14 days. Now, the case will be taken under advisement when the memos have been received. Our final case of the day is...